Welcome to the KSTE Farm Hour. Here's KSTE's Farmer Fred, Fred Hoffman.
The U.S.-Japan trade deal, it's now official. But there are winners and losers, including many important California agricultural commodities. Another widely used pesticide on California's farms will be unavailable beginning in 2020. We have the details. Deadlines are approaching for water agencies throughout California to be in compliance with the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. We take a deep dive into SGMA and what it means to California's farmers. All that, crop reports, the Valley weather forecast, and a lot more on this week's KSTE Farm Hour. Let's get started. Donald Trump has called his new trade deal with Japan a phenomenal victory for U.S. farmers. The agreement was recently signed. But there are winners and there are losers when it comes to California agriculture. The USDA's Gary Crawford talks about the winners.
At the White House Monday, the signing of the U.S.-Japan trade agreement, what President Trump calls
a game changer for our farmers and our ranchers, providing them with significantly enhanced access to a critical foreign market.
At the signing ceremony, President Trump said under the agreement, Japan will expand access to many U.S. food and ag products.
And as a result, 126 million Japanese consumers will have greater access to high-quality American almonds, blueberries, corn, wine, poultry, and egg products, beef, pork, wheat, and so much more.
And U.S. Trade Ambassador Robert Lighthizer said because of the lowering or elimination of Japanese tariffs on many of these products,
we think we'll have substantial additional sales as a result of this.
Because the agreement puts U.S. farmers on an equal footing with other countries supplying Japan with ag products. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
California is the number one dairy state in the nation. And one of the losers in the Japan-U.S. trade deal is butter. It's one of several U.S. dairy products that will not get improved access to Japan's 127 million consumers under the limited bilateral trade deal signed by Trump and the Japanese Prime Minister. The deal's full text has not been released and remains classified, but congressional aides, trade experts, and industry groups briefed on it told Reuters News Service that it offers worse access to Japan for some U.S. ag goods than the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is now an 11-country trade deal that Trump quit on his third day in office back in 2017. Now, Donald Trump did mention that wine was one of the big winners in the U.S.-Japan deal, and that is true. Well, those tariffs will fall with Japan from 15% to 7.1% on April 1st, 2020, basically the same level they would have been under the TPP. But among California agricultural commodities that didn't come out winners in this new agreement with Japan are the rice growers. They won't benefit from the new bilateral trade deal, as tariffs and quotas on U.S. rice imported to Japan set in the early 1990s remain in place. Under the TPP, Japan would have accepted 70,000 metric tons of American rice per year, tariff-free, but this was not included in the bilateral deal. And apart from the lack of improved access for butter and milk powder, exact details of cheese provisions in the U.S.-Japan deal are not yet known.
Talks between the U.S. and China regarding trade this week in Washington, D.C. bring a renewed hope of progress. The American Farm Bureau Federation says farmers and ranchers need a resolution that removes tariffs on U.S. ag products. Dave Salmonson, AFBF Senior Congressional Relations Director, says the talks are encouraging.
We're at a point where tariffs have continually escalated since basically spring of 2018, and I think both sides want to see if they can find a way out of this. So we're encouraged that this is going on. We hope they work hard to a conclusion.
Negotiators are mulling over a large list of issues, including forced technology transfer, intellectual property protection, and cybersecurity, along with ag trade. Salmonson says the escalating tariffs prompted China to reduce the amount of agricultural products purchased from the United States.
A couple years ago, we were selling over $20 billion of U.S. ag products to China, and this year we're expected to sell about $7 billion. That's no slackening demand in China. They're buying more around the world, but they're buying less from us because of the tariffs. China really does not want to talk bigger issues. They want to focus on tariffs. So that's why I guess the two countries haven't quite come to an agreement yet. They have different expectations of these talks.
Salmonson says U.S. agriculture needs momentum in the talks that lead to the removal of tariffs on ag products.
We really do want them, both sides, to get to work hammer out some kind of an agreement, get to the point where we can start unwinding these tariffs that have put such burdens on our exports to China and burdens on their exports to the U.S.
Michael Klimetz, Washington.
In order to compete better locally and globally, farmers need a robust broadband system. High-speed internet. Well, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced on October 7th that the USDA is investing $152 million in 19 projects to provide or improve rural broadband service in 14 states. Those states include Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Minnesota, Missouri, North Carolina, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, West Virginia, and Wisconsin. Any money for California? No. Taking a look at the upcoming weather for the southern Sacramento and northern San Joaquin valleys for the period October 14th through the 21st, AccuWeather is predicting mostly sunny skies, a few period of clouds on the 17th and 18th, but other than that, temperatures near normal with highs in the upper 70s and overnight lows in the upper 40s to low 50s. Here's this week's California crop report. In Tulare County, the cotton harvest has begun. Alfalfa continues to be cut, dried, and baled. Corn and sorghum harvest is wrapping up. Black-eyed peas were being harvested. In the valley, rice harvest continues at a steady pace, and the corn harvest is underway. Stone fruit orchards are being irrigated. Apricot, peach, plum, pluata, nectarine harvest continues to wind down for the season. Some stone fruit orchards were pruned and topped. Olive, pomegranate, and Asian pear harvest continues. Persimmon and quince are showing color. Wine grape harvest continues. Marginal sugar levels were reported for some producers in Tulare County, though. Valencia oranges and kiwi continue to be harvested. Raisins are being rolled and picked up for processing in some areas. The lemon and lime harvest continues steadily. Citrus groves are being pruned, hedgerowed, and skirted. Old citrus trees were being pushed out and replaced with new plantings. Orchards continue to be irrigated. Almond harvest continues to wrap up smoothly, with hard shell varieties coming in slightly below the nonpareil variety for a few producers. The walnut and pistachio harvest continues at a steady pace. In Monterey County, most lettuce and leafy green production has declined. Brassica harvest is continuing for a few more months, though. Fresno County reported processing tomato harvest has finished up, but is still ongoing in other parts of the state. Foothill rangeland and non-irrigated pasture are reported to be in fair to poor condition. Irrigated pasture was in good to excellent condition. Supplemental feeding of cattle is ongoing. Take the KSTE Farm Hour with you wherever you go. It's available at KSTE.com or the iHeartRadio app in streaming mode, or you can download it from your favorite third-party podcast aggregator such as iTunes. A widely used agricultural pesticide that California environmental officials say has been linked to brain damage in children will be banned after next year under an agreement reached with the manufacturer, according to California state officials. The Associated Press reports that all California sales of chlorpyrifos will end on February 6, 2020, and farmers will have until the end of 2020 to exhaust their supplies. The pesticide is used on numerous crops in the nation's largest agricultural producing state, including alfalfa, almonds, citrus, cotton, grapes, and walnuts. However, officials have agreed to budget $5.6 million to help pesticide manufacturers develop a safer alternative to chlorpyrifos.
To clarify, Western juniper in the sage steppe ecosystems of many parts of the West is not an invasive species.
Actually, Western juniper is a native species. The problem is that historically it was kept to fire safe areas by wildfires. And so what happens when it encroaches into more productive sagebrush communities is as its cover increases, it excludes sagebrush and then starts decreasing the understory, which would be your grasses and wildflowers. And after that happens, then it increases erosion risk. And so it can be pretty detrimental to the plant community.
And USDA researcher Kirk Davies says not only that, but Western juniper encroachment also impacts the sage steppe habitat of threatened sage-grouse species.
Very low cover of juniper essentially makes sagebrush steppe uninhabitable to sage-grouse. As little as 3% juniper cover and sage-grouse will quit using the areas.
That's why Davies and colleagues at the Agricultural Research Service in Eastern Oregon have studied what might be the best way to control Western juniper and other conifers that impact native sagebrush and sage grouse.
Really what the question came down to is between the two most common methods, prescribed burning it or cutting it down, essentially gave us the longest and most effective conservation.
Over three decades of ecological data was researched to see which control method worked best long term. And while previous studies by others revealed cutting junipers down may be the best short-term control method, Davey says his research indicates that to maintain long-range sagebrush dominance in a sage steppe ecosystem,
prescribed fire was much more effective.
Davies explains that while cutting juniper immediately reestablishes sagebrush dominance over time,
it wasn't nearly as effective, and those junipers would reestablish or refill in and decrease the sagebrush faster. So what we end up seeing is that fire and cutting both have critical roles in conservation of the sagebrush ecosystem.
One other observation from this research, Davey says, while yes, either juniper control method could result in exotic invasive grasses appearing,
it wasn't related to the treatment, it was related to site characteristics. The hotter, drier sites were more at risk. It didn't matter which treatment you did, you just need to be aware of that and be ready for that. You might have to do additional management such as seed after treating the junipers.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
According to the annual acreage report released by Mercaris, farmers will harvest 3.1 million acres of U.S. land that's been certified for organic field crop production. That's an increase of 7% over 2018. This increase is driven in large part by a surge in new certified organic field crop operations across the United States. But it's the West and the High Plains regions that saw the largest jump in organic harvested field crop acres in 2019.
The USMCA is what brought me here today. The largest trade deal in American history.
Vice President Mike Pence was at a Tyson's food plant in Nashville, Tennessee Monday, stumping for congressional ratification of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement.
The USMCA is projected to add $68 billion to our economy and create 176,000 new jobs. It's also estimated the USMCA would increase annual American agricultural exports by $2.2 billion.
And with the Vice President, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue, who earlier in the day told RFD-TV that as far as Congress approving USMCA,
I've been very optimistic about this getting done this fall.
He says there's wide support for it.
And I'm hoping we won't let this recent distractions politically interfere with doing the work of the people regarding these trade agreements. It's extremely important.
Late Monday, President Trump signed two trade agreements with Japan. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Tree fruit from California, as well as the rest of the United States, has been more plentiful, according to the California Farm Bureau Federation. Government estimates show apple production up 4%, peach crops up 13%, and the cherry harvest up 5% compared to a year ago. The overall U.S. pear crop will be similar to last year. California's production, though, will be up 15%. Grape production will also be close to last year's, with the California table grape crop expected to match last year's record. A bit of bad news, though, on the citrus front. The coming season's navel orange harvest will be slightly smaller, that according to a preseason crop forecast. Estimators told the California Farm Bureau that California's farmers will harvest enough navel oranges to fill 76 million 40-pound cartons, but that's down 7% from the previous season. The vast majority of the oranges come from the San Joaquin Valley. California, though, leads the nation in orange production.
This past growing season was the largest U.S. citrus crop, production-wise, in a three-year period.
Up substantially, about 31% from historic low in 2017-18. That was a very low production year because most of the states saw production declines that year, but it was also mostly because of the losses from Hurricane Irma that hit Florida in September 2017.
Yet as USDA research economist Agnes Perez notes, the 2019-20 domestic citrus crop is not expected to surpass the production totals from the previous year. A first look at this season's navel orange crop in California has a forecast of a 7% reduction in production. Meanwhile, Florida citrus acreage is expected to continue its historic trends of annual declines, due primarily to continued impacts from citrus greening. Sunshine State citrus acreage has declined 40% since discovery of citrus greening about 15 years ago. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
California farmers are producing more pistachios to meet rising global demand. The California Farm Bureau Federation reports that this year's harvest is expected to produce the third largest crop in state history, and growers expect to produce the state's first billion-pound crop next year. Rising affluence in China and India, coupled with increasing health consciousness globally, are raising demand for the nut, which has enjoyed brisk exports to China, that despite tariffs resulting from the ongoing trade war. Well, if you want to believe AccuWeather, their winter forecast for the year says there will be plenty of rain and snow in California. A normal season in terms of snowfall. Well, that's good for water users, especially California agriculture. Heavens knows we've had water shortages over the years. We've had droughts over the years, including one that lasted 5 years just a few years ago. And California agriculture, as you know, uses maybe 85% of the groundwater here in the state. However, that's changing because back in 2014, Governor Brown signed SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. How's that going on? What are the deadlines? And there are deadlines approaching. Lois Henry is following the story. She's the CEO and editor of SJV Water, a nonprofit independent online news publication dedicated to covering water issues in the San Joaquin Valley. Former reporter for the Fresno Bee and the Bakersfield Californian. And Lois, as 2020 approaches, there are some deadlines approaching, aren't there?
Yeah, there's a really big deadline approaching right at the start of the year, and that is January 31st, 2020. All of these organizations that were formed under SGMA, and this is a bit of alphabet soup here, these organizations that were formed under SGMA are known as Groundwater Sustainability Agencies, so GSAs, and they are required to cover all the ground in each sub-basin and in the main basin in California that is problematic right now is the San Joaquin Valley Basin, and then there are sub-basins within that, Kern, Tule, Madera, et cetera. And every piece of ground in those sub-basins must be covered by a GSA. And these GSAs are essentially a new layer of government in California. And these GSAs, which are mostly made up of agricultural water districts, there are some cities, et cetera, that are involved in some counties. Mostly it's agricultural water districts. These GSAs must come up with a groundwater sustainability plan, how they're going to fix problems that are happening in these sub-basins, such as subsidence and water quality issues and groundwater storage shrinkage, which is a huge problem. They have to come up with those GSPs, those plans, and turn them into the state by January 31st, 2020. And that means that, you know, backing up, they have to have made them public by about August or right around now, because they have to, these are public agencies, they have to go through the public process and public comment period. If there's problems with them and they need to be redone, which is happening in Kern on a large scale, Kern County, they only have 3.5 or less months to get that done. And these are immensely complicated. They are like an EIR on steroids. They are, you know, hydrology Bibles. They've got water budgets. They include, you know, there's so many consultants involved that you just can't, you know, you can't walk through the room without bumping into one of these guys. And these are major endeavors, and they have essentially little to no time to get them done and get them to the state.
And we'd found out during the last drought that when you don't have surface water, well, then you're going to be pumping groundwater. And when you pump too much groundwater, you've got overdraft that can cause, as you mentioned, subsidence. For instance, the Fryant-Kern Canal running backwards due to collapse.
The California Aqueduct also has some subsidence. The Fryant-Kern Canal has got a lot of headlines because it is acute. It's actually pooling up in areas, but so is the aqueduct.
And so what's a farmer to do if they can't draw surface water? They have to go to groundwater. And the option then, if they can't get groundwater, then is to fallow their land. And one story that's been making the rounds lately about one use for that fallowed land, and we're seeing more and more farmers do this, especially in your area there in the southern San Joaquin Valley, is converting very good farmland into solar farms with solar panels.
Right. That's been going on in Kern County for some amount of time. Gosh, I wrote about that in 2014 or 15, because as you mentioned, the drought was at its absolute highest in the or worst, I guess you could say, in 2015. And you started to see a lot of folks around the Arvin area converting to solar because they didn't have any water to farm. And you're right. Fallowing is becoming it is one of the quote projects under the groundwater sustainability plans for reducing the draw on the groundwater. But fallowing is really interesting. I've been following some stuff in the Eastern Thule GSA. Not all ground is considered equal. And so it's going to be so tough on farmers because not everybody is going to be eligible for fallowing. If you have better land, and even though you may have worse water rights or availability, if you have better land, you may not be in the fallowing eligibility pool, because in some land is sinking under, like say around the Kern, the Bryant-Kern Canal. What they're finding is that there's plots of land that are sinking worse in certain areas, and that it's worse to tap that groundwater because that's what's causing more of the damage to the canal. So they want to fallow that land. Well, that land actually has pretty good water rights. So they're asking those farmers to voluntarily fallow their land, whereas other farmers who maybe don't have as good of ground or good of soil aren't really going to be eligible for fallowing. So it's going to be really, it's not just anybody with land can voluntarily fallow it or sell it to the district, et cetera. It's going to be really difficult. It's not going to be pretty.
No, it's not. And then you have even more intrigue, and even there have been documentary movies on the subject of certain landowners building pipelines to move water from one district to another under the darkness of night.
Well, that happened during the height of the drought. I actually wrote about that as well. And Mark Arax, who's a journalist in Fresno, he wrote about it as initially, and then I got on it and wrote about it. That had to do with two particular farmers. One, his name is Vitovich, and then the Resnicks, who are the owners of the wonderful company.
And Paramount Farms, too.
Paramount Farms, yeah. So that was kind of I think that was probably a one-off kind of a situation. I mean, the Resnicks, the wonderful company, they were facing potentially losing thousands and thousands of acres during the height of the drought, and Vitovich stood to make a lot of money by moving that water. And I think that since people kind of got caught onto it, I don't know that that's really going to happen again, because the big issue with that is that they were moving it out of Kings County into Kern County. And that's a big no-no. Most counties do not allow you to move groundwater out of their county, especially without permission and proper licensing, et cetera. And they were running pipelines literally across people's land that those folks didn't even know that the pipelines were on their land. So they obviously had not given permission. So it was, that was a really desperate situation, I think, in 2015.
Oh, and the battle for surface water continues as well. You've written about that, and that's a very difficult issue to determine who has senior water rights and the threat of losing those senior water rights because of new laws that are on the books. It's a very difficult, complex situation as far as who's going to get the water. And it's complicated even more by the changeover in the crops that are being grown, especially in the southern San Joaquin Valley. Now, all of a sudden, you've got crops that need water year-round, the nut crops, the walnuts, the pistachios, the almonds.
Right. It's a real catch-22. I mean, you can't really blame the farmers for this. I can remember back in the 90s, and I don't know if you remember it, but there was a drought in the mid-90s. And we fallowed in Kern County, I think like 300,000 or 400,000 acres went out of production. And it was mostly row crops. We were the cotton kings down here, and we had a lot of tomatoes and melons, et cetera. And so that all went fallow during the 90s. And that was also the time when there was the Monterey Agreement. So the state water project was sort of undergoing this, like, well, we think we should move more water during drought to municipal uses because these are obviously hardened requirements, you know, people being able to drink their water and have water to bathe and flush toilets, as opposed to you can plow under a field of melons and nobody's going to die. Right. So there was this push and pull in the Monterey agreements that some people feel were a secret kind of a deal. They resulted in a number of agricultural interests giving up a certain portion of their water rights under contract. But in exchange, they got on equal footing with the municipality organizations, just to sort of simplify this. So after that, they were looked down on because, well, you're wasting water. You're using water for alfalfa. You're using water for cotton. You're using water for all these sort of low value crops. I remember that was a big deal in the 90s. You know, you're wasting our water, using it for low value crops. So farmers turned around and went, yeah, you know, you're right. I could get more money if I had these permanent crops. So you started to see a real increase in vineyards, table grapes, not raisin grapes, but mostly table grapes. And then you started to see almonds and pistachios. And I had some friends who were almond farmers up in Merced, and they had been for generations. The marketing, they started reaching out to other countries and marketing these products to other countries. And they told me how they were just shocked how, you know, for years they were selling their almonds for, or as they say in Merced, almonds, for, you know, $1 or $2 a pound. And now, you know, boom, it's up to $5 a pound. You're going to see farmers, they're not stupid, they're going to go for where the good business is. And so they started moving in that direction, and with drip irrigation, and then, you know, the ability to really target your nutrients, your fertilizers, you could expand those permanent crops into ground that maybe wasn't so great and maybe shouldn't have been farmed. That's kind of a big debate right now, is that the expansion of these permanent crops, it wasn't just converting them over from what had already been farmed, but they really expanded, especially on the west side, and that's a big debate as to whether that should have happened. But I'm sorry I'm rambling, but it's just, you know, the issue of permanent crops. And during the drought, we heard a lot from people saying, you know, how terrible it was that it was, you know, cost a gallon of water for a single almond. And it's like, well, there's another side to that story that people have to understand. Farmers have to make a living, and they are going to make a much better living with going to these permanent crops. They're going to be able to pay their workers better. They're going to be able to hire more workers. They're going to be able to have workers year round. And those are all good things. You know, you have to look at the yin and the yang of all of this.
We're talking with Lois Henry. She's the CEO and editor of SJV Water, a nonprofit independent online news publication dedicated to covering water issues in the San Joaquin Valley. And we're talking about some upcoming dates that are very important in the implementation of SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. One of the big areas of contention have to do with marginal farmland, those areas on the eastern side and western side of the Central Valley that used to be pasture land that are now home to expensive permanent crops, especially nut crops, that need water year-round. Will they be able to get water under the implementation of SGMA? Lois Henry explains.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of where the crux of the debate is going to lie. And even water agencies are really kind of looking askance at their brethren water agencies that are out there on those fringes. One of the debates that erupted at the story that I just covered, September 25th, at the Kern Groundwater Authority, was that the Kern Groundwater Authority assigned native yield, because the controversy was that the water budgets came in on these GSPs, these groundwater sustainability plans. And if you took all these numbers, because there's 16 different member agencies within the Kern Groundwater Authority, and they each got to write their own water budget, right? And these all came in, and apparently a landowner took all of them and crunched all the numbers, and it showed that, according to these water budgets, that if you believed them, the Kern base subbasin was only 90,000 acre feet in overdraft. Well, everybody knows that's not true. Modeling and other information has shown that we're more in the realm of 300,000 acre feet.
That's a big difference.
Yes. And that's a yearly figure, by the way, on average. So they said, hey, you got to go and redo these water budgets. And by the way, Kern Groundwater Authority then said, you're not going to get to choose native yield. Native yield is the water that just sort of seeps into the basin naturally. It's not owned. It's not like a bank recharge. Like, okay, I bought, you know, 10 acre feet from the SWP and I'm going to put it in this bank over here. So I have this 10 acre feet. You can't count that as native yield. This is other, you know, sort of percolation and precipitation and variety of different waters. So the Kern Groundwater sort of took the reins on this and said the native yield is going to be 0.15 acre feet per acre of ground spread across the entire subbasin. And immediately some of the water agencies that are in the center of our subbasin, because our subbasin, according to DWR, goes up into the foothills on either side, on the west and the east side, which, as you mentioned, are historically almost always been pasture land. But now permanent crops are starting to creep up into those areas. And so Dana Munn, who is the general manager for the Shafter-Wasco Irrigation District, stood up and said, you know, hey, that's not fair. Those fringe areas they've never had usable groundwater. They don't have this is, you shouldn't assign this native yield to those areas. And his contention is that it creates a lot of different problems. You have maybe a water agency like Semitropic that spreads from those foothill areas into the valley area. And you could start assigning extra native yield to the people who are in the valley portion if they own land, you know, all the way up into the foothills. And he was just sort of mentioning that, you know, you're going to game this. You know, if you cut out those fringe areas, it would afford the farmers in the middle area, you know, 3.3 acre feet per acre of native yield. And that's much more fair, et cetera, et cetera. If you're going to give native yield to these fringe areas, you're just going to encourage more development, meaning farming development, and you know, we can't have that, et cetera. So it is a huge controversy. And I think I really do think that's going to be the crux of it, especially when you start talking about fallowing being a key part of the groundwater sustainability plans. And nobody really wants to talk about that, and they don't really want to suggest that is a key part of the groundwater sustainability plans. But I think that we all know that it's going to be impossible to, quote, find new water. Everything that's happening in the Delta is ratcheting down on exports, you know, despite what the Trump administration may be trying to do. I mean,
no, the lawyers will win that one. That's going to be a battle that's going to continue in the courts for years.
So anyway, sorry to ramble. It's just one of those topics. You got me started on it.
Well, that's okay. And in fact, there is some confusion about native yield, natural seepage. Some people would say, well, wait a minute, what about recharging? And that's, you know, one good thing about Southern San Joaquin Valley soil. It's very adaptable for recharging from rainwater.
Right. And you're right. There is a debate on what constitutes native yield. Like I used to say all the time, one man's seepage is another man's recharge.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had those battles here in Kern County where, you know, when somebody starts wanting to line their canals with concrete so that they, you know, maintain more of their own water, then somebody raises a hand and says, wait a minute, you're taking away my seepage. And it's like, no, that's not seepage, or they call it recharge. You're taking away my recharge. No, that's not recharge. That's seepage, and I want to stop the seepage. So, yeah, there's a big debate about that as well. You know, what is native yield, especially even when it comes to rivers and streams? You know, we have the Pozo and the Caliente and Deer Creek and then the Kern River and then the bigger rivers. And almost all of these rivers are fully appropriated, or at least have been up until recent years, fully appropriated. Somebody owns that water. And in the Kern River case, the city even owns the land and the adjacent lands. It owns the riverbed and then the lands right next to it, all the way to the mouth of the canyon going into the foothills. So the city's position is, you know, we own this water right. There's two other water right owners on the Kern River, and that water is taken off into canals very quickly and moved off. But then the city has its portion. There are people now saying, well, if you run your water down the riverbed and there's seepage, which obviously there is, then that should be claimed as native yield to the entire basin. And the city's saying, no, that's our water. It's the same as if we bought it off of the State Water Project and banked it. So you can't claim it. We're claiming it. And by the way, the city also uses it for recharging its city municipal wells. But there's the public trust doctrine that says any water that's run in a natural riverbed, it belongs to the public. So I foresee a potential big lawsuit over this. And there's been grumbling about it for years. But now that Sigma is saying, look, you know, all these molecules, they have to be accounted for and divvied up, and everybody has to know how much there is and who's taking it and how much is being recharged. I kind of wonder if people are going to, they're going to say it's worth it now to go to a lawsuit on this. Sigma is very confusing how things work and how they don't work, because Sigma, one of the main tenets of Sigma was that it would not alter water rights. It's black and white. It's in there where this is not going to alter water rights. Well, except when you start looking at these issues with rivers, if people see an opportunity to sue, to say, hey, this right has not been perfected, you don't have a right to this, then water rights could easily be upended. I mean, you could make the argument that Sigma didn't do that. Somebody suing did, but nobody would have sued if it hadn't been for Sigma. So, I mean, I think it's going to be the Wild West around here for a while.
I think you had it right when you said we should encourage our children to grow up to be water lawyers.
Yes. Yeah. If you want to be taken care of in your old age, have your kids be water lawyers, because they will be gainfully employed for their entire life and they will make vast amounts of money.
Now, one final question that we were discussing before we started the interview, and we don't know the answer to, according to the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, the question I get from a lot of farmers is, when's that guy going to show up on my property to put a meter on my well? And we don't know.
But yeah, we really don't know.
Or will it even be necessary with the advancements in technology?
I have a feeling that metering is still going to go on, because the evapotranspiration, am I saying that right?
Yes.
People have questions about as well. And there's some people who still to this day don't trust it. They would prefer to know what's going on. And there's, because some districts do already meter. I think Buena Vista down here already has slapped meters on almost all of its at least district owned wells. I think it's going to be a while, though, because, you've got the groundwater sustainability plans going to the state as of January 31st, 2020. And remember, I told you just one GSA here has 16 of those plans and they're 1,000 pages each. Okay. So that's just one GSA in one sub-basin. You can imagine going up and down the state how much paperwork this is to go through. So I kind of think there's going to be, and I'm trying to work on a story right now, if I could get anybody from the DWR to call me back. I'm wondering what the process is going to be and what their manpower is to process all this. And do they get these GSPs as of January 31st and then February 1st, they're like, they stamp them with like approved or denied, or is there a negotiation period? Like, oh, hey, we don't care for this section. Can you redo this? That kind of give and take. I don't know. And then, when do these plans get implemented? When is the start date for that? I don't know that either. And Sigma, I don't think is clear. I mean, it gives a deadline of 2040 to get your groundwater sub-basin into, quote, sustainability. What happens in those intervening years on individual farms is really hard to say. I mean, I would just suggest that everybody keep in close touch with their GSA managers. And you can go on the DWR website and find what GSA you're in.
California really playing catch up with the rest of the nation. Most other states have had water metering for decades.
Right. Some form of control over their groundwater. In the western United States. I mean, obviously in the east, not as big of a deal. But yeah, like Arizona has had groundwater 20, 30 years. They've had groundwater laws. Colorado as well, I believe.
Well, I think it was Mark Twain who said, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting.
Yeah, I heard that.
Yeah, and we're living it. The Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, the saga continues. Lois Henry will be covering it in her online news publication, SJV Water. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I had been a reporter for many, many years. We all know that newspapers, have had a really hard time. The internet has taken a huge bite out of advertising. So the advertising model is really, I think, probably over with in terms of print publications. But my idea was that maybe people would pay for, and maybe I could get grants for, a publication that was focused on a very specific and somewhat complicated and hard to access issue like water. I created a nonprofit organization. It's tax exempt. and I'll be trying to get grants. I did receive one grant for startup, so thank you very much, Virginia Alfred Harrell Foundation, for that. I went live. It's online only, so I'm not going to do any kind of print publication to save money. And you can sign up for free. You have to sign up and do a little registration thing, because also part of my idea is that if I have enough eyeballs, maybe that will attract more grant money. And you can also pay for a subscription if you want to help support it. But it just went live Sunday, past Sunday. It went live. So it is live, sjvwater.org.
All right. You can sign up. It's easy to sign up and read it as the stories come out. Lois Henry, CEO and editor of SJV Water. Well, thanks for clearing up the mud on the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. I appreciate it.
If anybody could do that, they would be sought after high and low. It's going to be a complicated story for a while, Fred.
Yes, it will. And the saga continues. Thank you, Lois.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the KSTE Farm Hour. Heard every Sunday from noon until 1 p.m. Pacific Time. And available anytime as a podcast. Download it at KSTE.com.